From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA senior political analyst, Brian Padden. Our topic, a nation in crisis. Our special guest, Alan J. Lichtman, distinguished professor of history at American University here in Washington. He's the author of the recently published book, Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America. Alan is no stranger to these VOA microphones, a well-known analyst of U.S. elections and the U.S. political system. Alan was our guest in February when we spoke with him about the impeachment of U.S. President Donald J. Trump. Alan Lichtman is the author of many acclaimed books on U.S. political history, such as White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Case for Impeachment. On this edition of the program, we'll talk with Professor Lichtman about the political upheaval in the United States in the aftermath of the death of George Floyd, a 46-year-old African-American man who died last week at the hands of white Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, while three other officers stood by. Floyd's death, captured on video, shocked Americans of all backgrounds and has sparked widespread demonstrations against police brutality and racial injustice in dozens of U.S. cities. All four officers were fired, and Chauvin, who pressed his knee into Floyd's neck for more than 8 minutes, was ultimately charged with second-degree murder. It is very difficult in the United States to charge police officers with murder, but Floyd's graphic death at the hands of law enforcement officers has reignited debate over the need for lasting reforms in training, recruitment, and in the overall culture of policing, including excessive and disproportionate use of deadly force against African Americans. On Monday, June 1, law enforcement officers used force to clear a group of peaceful demonstrators in Lafayette Square outside the White House so that President Trump could pose for photos, brandishing a Bible outside the nearby historic St. John's Episcopal Church. Critics rejected White House explanations, saying the gesture was meant to show respect for religious freedom. Reverend Marianne Buddy, whose diocese includes St. John's Church, was appalled that the church would be used as a backdrop for political purposes. Critics from across the political spectrum have accused the president of dividing rather than uniting our nation, suffering under the weight of multiple crises, the coronavirus pandemic and its dire economic consequences, including record unemployment and civil unrest, all of which have disproportionately hurt African Americans and minorities. In addition, Mr. Trump's threat to deploy the U.S. military against U.S. civilians caused an outcry from several senior military figures, among whom retired General Jim Mattis, Mr. Trump's first defense secretary, who said in a statement, quote, "I have watched this week's unfolding events, angry and appalled." General Mattis goes on to say, quote, "Militarizing our response, as we witnessed in Washington, D.C., sets up a false conflict between the military and civilian society. It erodes the moral ground that ensures a trusted bond between men and women in uniform and the society they are sworn to protect and of which they themselves are a part." Close quote. In the United States, armed forces are not meant for deployment in domestic settings or for policing, but rather to combat foreign enemies. We'll also talk with Alan Lichtman about his provocative new book, Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America. Lichtman argues that the amendment has not only been distorted by the gun lobby, but it is also anachronistic in today's America. He believes the only way to reduce the epidemic of gun violence in the United States is by repealing the Second Amendment. He believes this action would pave the way for comprehensive national gun control and safety measures that have, until now, eluded us. Well, Alan Lichtman joins us via Skype as we continue to social distance. Alan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
And I'm delighted, as always, to welcome my colleague, Brian Padden. Well, Alan Lichtman, let's talk about what has been happening across our country, widespread protests trying to appeal for an end to what is perceived as a pattern of racial injustice and police brutality. What is your reaction to this moment?
This is a pivot point in the history of the United States. There are two paths that lie before us. One of the paths was laid out by President Trump on Monday, and that was the path of repression and militarization, that's somehow the answer to social inequality, to racial injustice, to poverty, is to impose military order, to use the American military against the American people. That is not the American way. That is the way of Vladimir Putin and dictators throughout the world. The other path is to actually address the real issues and not use this pivotal moment for political purposes or to impose strong man rule. And that path is a difficult one. These problems have been with us, as we know, for hundreds of years. But these pivot points in American history do give us a chance to address deep-seated problems in America and deal with them. I'm reminded of the Great Depression. You know, Franklin Roosevelt took office at the very bottom of the Great Depression, 25% unemployment in the United States, businesses bleeding red ink, farms being foreclosed. And we could have gone down the path of chaos, disorder, strongman rule. Instead, Franklin Roosevelt and the American people seized that moment, that opportunity to reform our society, to adopt reforms like Social Security, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the federal guarantee of bank deposits, labor collective bargaining rights, minimum wages and maximum hours. We are at a similar pivot point in America today, and two paths lead before us, and it makes all the difference for the future of this country which path we take.
Let me let Brian Patton in for a question.
Yes. Hi, Professor Lichtman. You very strongly laid out the pivot point we're at and the clear choice ahead. But are you concerned that the presumptive Democratic Party nominee, Joe Biden, should he be concerned that the protest against police brutality could turn independent law and order type voters away and reduce his own support among African Americans?
You know, there is always that tension. Any protest movement is going to be chaotic. It's going to attract all kinds of different persons, including those who want to exploit the protests for their own purposes. And by the way, the president could not be more fundamentally wrong in blaming violence on left-wing extremists. In fact, right-wing extremism has been vastly more dangerous to America than anything coming out of the left. According to the American Defamation League, there were 42 domestic terrorist killings in 2019, 90% linked to right-wing extremists, none linked to so-called Antifa. So there is always that danger. But the critical thing Joe Biden has to do is transcend that and point out, yes, there are those who would exploit this either for, you know, immediate selfish purposes or for long-term political gain. You know, for a long time, the far right has tried to provoke a race war, tried to provoke chaos in America. And they see this as an incredible opportunity to do that. But Joe Biden and those who believe in social justice have to make us understand that you cannot define the protest, you cannot define the movement, you cannot define the issue by the very few extremists that are trying to exploit this or by the criminals that are trying to use it for their own ends.
Alan Lichtman, talk about what you see are the root causes of what we're seeing, the protests, particularly against excessive police brutality, ending in the death of George Floyd and many others before him, particularly men of color and women as well. What needs to happen, in your view, in the run-up to our election? Mr. Trump and Attorney General Barr are apparently saying that it's Antifa, the so-called anti-fascist groups, the more left-wing groups, without really showing much evidence, although they're saying that there's intelligence that say that they're involved. But I wonder to what extent white supremacists are also infiltrating and trying to create chaos. And Mr. Trump may even be encouraging them through some sort of dog whistles to come out and actually help disrupt and pour fuel on the fire. What are the structural changes you think should be made?
The president, the attorney general, and the president's inner circle are perpetrating two huge frauds on the American people. The first fraud is that somehow this is all being pushed by left-wing extremists. As I already explained, it is right-wing extremists that is the real danger in America that's been responsible for 90% or more of the killings, and that has long pursued the goal of promoting chaos in America, and in the most extreme elements of the far right, even promoting a race war. That's something Donald Trump refuses to acknowledge, and in fact, in many ways, has encouraged the extreme right wing, such as calling the neo-Nazis and the anti-Semites and the Ku Klux Klanners and the Charlottesville demonstrations as very fine people among them. So we always have to be clear-eyed with that. Second great fraud they're perpetrating is it's only a few bad apples in the police forces. And if we just get rid of those few bad apples, somehow all our problems will be solved. That could not be more incorrect. There is systematic racism, unfortunately, that runs through much of our police forces and needs to be rooted out through new recruitment methods, new training, clear guidelines, much more swift and sure punishment of racist activities by police. Just focusing on the so-called bad apples will do absolutely nothing to solve a problem that's been running for hundreds of years in the United States. And of course, there is the fundamental inequalities in America, particularly inequalities of class and inequalities of race that have been endemic to our society for hundreds of years, but have gotten much worse in the last four decades or so. In the last four decades or so, we have now reached a point where economic inequality is equal to or greater where it was on the eve of the Great Depression of 1929. All the gains of the New Deal and the reforms of Franklin Roosevelt that have brought about more income equality have been wiped out. And of course, we have long-term endemic racial inequality in America in the way in which polices deal with non-white peoples in America and access to health care and access to credit and access to good jobs. There is an enormous racial divide in America that has to be addressed at its roots and can be. You know, we saw the enormous progress that was made with the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. We need similar progress again. And none of this will be solved by violence and policing. Not that we don't need policing, not that these small businesses don't need protection. That's fine. But a solution of violence and repression will only lead us down the road to the destruction, not the salvation of our democracy.
Of course, in the very disparities about which you talk, whether economic, racial, are being severely exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. So not just the last four decades, but the last 4 months, we have seen an enormous decline, and many people have criticized the manner in which President Trump has managed the coronavirus pandemic. And some say that he is trying to change the subject, so to speak, by blaming many of these peaceful protesters for the damages being done and the looting taking place.
Yes.
So that's part of it. But we'll get to that in a moment. Let's take a break. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Alan Lichtman. He's Distinguished Professor of History at American University and author of the new book, Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America, which we will talk a bit more about in the second half. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA senior political analyst Brian Padden. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out to a loyal fan, Bienvenue Jengeza from Uriva in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He currently lives in Johannesburg, South Africa. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We are still here and still monitoring, notwithstanding our inability to get into the studio as we practice social distancing. Well, back to our program, and let me turn to Brian Padden for a question to Alan Lichtman.
Yes, I wanted to follow up and ask about when you talk about pivot points between parties, are we also at a pivot point in our own democracy? Are you concerned that the bitter partisanship, the difficulties and discrepancies about voting and mail-in voting and how people might vote in the upcoming election. Are you concerned that this election in November will go off and that the democratic system of government will still be able to function in a nation so divided?
I'm very concerned about the functioning of our democracy. We've seen a wholesale attack being led by the president on free and fair opportunities to vote, not just opposition to mail-in voting, but support for things like the draconian purging of people off the voter rolls, voter ID laws, which we know fall most harshly upon minorities. This is extremely frightening. In fact, we are dividing, as you say, not just into two nations, red and blue, in terms of political outlook, but also in terms of opportunities to vote. The laws could not be more different in blue states like my state of Maryland and red states like the state of Texas. And that is really sad. And that's why I look for some hope to a candidate like Joe Biden. Joe Biden has lots of faults. You know, he's gaffe-prone. He's not inspirational. But he has one thing we may need at this critical pivot point in our history. That is, he is a uniter. He is a conciliator. He has suffered great tragedy in his own life, losing a wife, two children. He can empathize with ordinary Americans. And maybe, you know, a non-polarizing conciliatory figure like Joe Biden is what we need at this moment to try to moderate the extreme polarization that we've seen in this country and maybe restore the health of our democracy. I think we are at a pivot point in our democracy. And I think we have to look at Donald Trump's talk Monday night, his invocation of a military solution, beyond the immediate impact, and see it as a move towards autocracy, a move towards making America more like Turkey or Russia or China. In fact, Lieutenant General retired Honoré, who led the Katrina relief, said, when I looked at this, and this is a general, I thought I was looking at something going on in Turkey, not something going on in the United States.
And yet you've listed the major concerns about President Trump as a president, as a candidate, as a threat to democracy. And yet he still maintains plus 40% support in the country, according to polls. And according to your own 13 keys to winning the presidency, he fails on a number of key factors that you list. His party lost in the congressional 2018 election. He was involved in a major scandal. The economy is in recession. He has no major policy success to brag about. So why is he still competitive? Why is there a real possibility he will be reelected?
Well, let me say, you know, you alluded to my 13 keys to the White House system, which has been correct since 1984 in predicting election results. And quite frankly, 5 months ago, it was looking pretty good for the reelection of Donald Trump. But as you say, things have changed. There are now many other of my keys in jeopardy: the short-term election year economy, the long-term economy, and social unrest. I've not made a final prediction yet, but things are looking a lot more dire for Donald Trump than they were 5 months ago. And, you know, Donald Trump does appeal to a certain anxiety within a minority, you know, about 40% of the American people, and that is they see their country changing. They see their country changing demographically. You know, we're moving towards a majority non-white country. They see their country changing religiously. They see some of their traditional religious values being challenged and undermined. And Donald Trump appeals to those anxieties and a desire perhaps to return to an earlier America when their values and their outlook were not so challenged and so threatened.
So, Alan Lichtman, as you said, President Trump has been appealing to that portion of America, his base, when he said last week that he was, quote, mobilizing all available federal resources, civilian and military, to stop the rioting and looting, to end the destruction and arson, and to protect the rights of law-abiding Americans, including your Second Amendment rights, unquote. I do want to get into that, use that as a way to segue into your new book. But also as a historian, I'd like to get your view on this type of rhetoric at this moment.
Yes.
At a moment when many presidents in the past perhaps have used this moment to try to unite America, to acknowledge what is behind these protests, the police brutality, inequality in America. How unusual is this type of rhetoric?
It's unusual, but not unprecedented. Of course, our greatest, most revered presidents have used moments of crisis both to unite the nation and to move us forward into a better future. In the wake of the enormous destruction of the Civil War, which based on today's population would have meant many millions of battlefield and disease deaths, what did President Abraham Lincoln appeal to? The better angels of our nature. He appealed to healing and moving ahead to a more just nation. That really meant something, perhaps the moment of greatest crisis. George W. Bush, in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, did not use that to divide America or to declare a war on Islam. He gave one of the great speeches to a joint session of Congress, uniting speech, not a cowardly speech, one which indeed in a flinty-eyed way challenged terrorism, but also brought us together and gave us the real meaning of our democracy. The closest analog, of course, to what Donald Trump is doing is Richard Nixon, you know, one of the least esteemed of our presidents, the only one to resign. He sought to exploit disorder and protest, which were, like the ones today, quite legitimate. They had real grievances, real issues, mostly with the war in Vietnam, but also with systematic racism and inequality. And he sought to exploit it by becoming the law and order president. And shockingly, he even invited demonstrators and protesters into his rallies and speeches so he could denounce them and make a political point of denouncing them. His vice president, Spiro Agnew, took the point on this, called them hoodlums and thugs, and blamed the liberal media for egging on these illegitimate demonstrations. So sadly, one could only wish that President Donald Trump could take more of Abraham Lincoln and George W. Bush and less of Richard Nixon.
All three Republicans. Alan,
and
let's talk.
Deliberately did that.
Exactly. Let's talk about your book, Repeal the Second Amendment. Talk about the fallacy of the Second Amendment here in the United States, used as an excuse for people to buy guns with very little regulation. Why did you write this book? Especially because the Second Amendment is seen as somehow sacrosanct here in America. What possessed you?
What possessed me to write the book is what you saw from Donald Trump on Monday, a gratuitous reference to the Second Amendment. Why? Because Donald Trump has exploited the Second Amendment to encourage his followers to arm themselves and perhaps even to use violence against their opponents. You know, when he thought Hillary Clinton might get elected and appoint liberal judges, what did he say? There would be a Second Amendment solution to that, which meant the use of guns and the use of violence. And that's where we've come with the Second Amendment, which was originally passed not to give people an unlimited right to keep and bear arms and use them as they will, but to promote collective security through a well-organized militia. I'll quote from a 1955 memo, which said that throughout our history, and in all court decisions, the Second Amendment has been interpreted as providing a collective right of self-defense, not an individual right for an unlimited capacity to keep and bear arms. That memo did not come from some liberal organization. It came from the National Rifle Association. Then what happened in the late 20th century, in the so-called revolt at Cincinnati, in their meeting at Cincinnati in the late 1970s, a new militant group took over the NRA, and they hijacked the Second Amendment to distort its meaning as though it was meant to give individuals an unlimited right to keep and bear arms. And they used the Second Amendment as a hammer to let anyone get guns. They don't care who gets guns. You know, criminals can get guns. Domestic abusers can get guns. In fact, last year, the NRA vociferously, fiercely campaigned against renewing the Violence Against Women Act because it would deny guns to domestic abusers who routinely turn guns upon women. So the Second Amendment has been hijacked, it's been misinterpreted, and it has been used as a hammer to block the constructive gun control measures like universal background checks that are supported by 80 to 90% of Americans. I wrote the book because we have unchecked gun violence in America. 15,000 gun deaths approximately a year by murder, 23,000 more by suicide. You know, your chances of being murdered by a gun in America is 20 times, not 20%, 20 times greater than that of our peer nations in the G7 group of nations plus Australia. You know, if the NRA is right, we should be the safest, not the least safe of our peer nations. I wrote the book because nationally, the gun control movement, despite overwhelming public support, has achieved nothing. In fact, we've slipped backwards with the repeal of the assault weapons ban. And the game needs to be changed because the strategy that is now being pursued by the gun control movement, "we support the Second Amendment, but," doesn't work. It inspires no one. I understand it is incredibly difficult to repeal an amendment. It's been done, though. The Prohibition Amendment was repealed 14 years after it was started. And just re-energizing the movement and giving it a new goal, I think, would be an enormous game changer.
Let me just quickly follow up, because you pointed out how the gun control movement always says, you know, we support the Second Amendment, but, and like you said, it simply doesn't seem to be working. You even quoted in your book retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, who said in 2018 that a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Second Amendment would be simple and would do more to weaken the NRA's ability to stymie legislative debate and block constructive gun control legislation than any other available option. But how simple? It doesn't seem simple. Why would it be simple? I mean, how concretely, how would you do this?
Yeah,
it's so counterintuitive.
We could repeal the Second Amendment, which doesn't mean, by the way, and I want to make this crystal clear before I go on, the confiscation of guns. For over 200 years, the Second Amendment was interpreted only in support of a militia. No one confiscated guns during those 200 plus years. Let me make that clear. You can get guns still for sporting, for collecting, for legitimate self-defense. How do you repeal the Second Amendment and get reasonable gun control? Same way you repealed the Prohibition Amendment. You've got to start an important grassroots movement. And I think this movement should be led by women. Women are often the ones who suffer most from gun violence in America. And we have now mothers' movements, which have gotten a million followers. And I think they can be the lead in the movement. Secondly, we need disillusioned members of the NRA to turn around. The NRA is in disarray. It's been revealed as a racket. You know, it takes money from legitimate persons concerned with gun rights, and it pays its CEO $1.4 million. It pays a half a dozen or more of its top employees over $600,000 and basically pays terrible wages to its ordinary employees. It's a racket. So we need people from the NRA to turn around. We need the business community to turn around on this, just like the business community led by John D. Rockefeller Jr. turned around on prohibition. He was a teetotaler who had been very strongly support of prohibition, but decided this was counterproductive. And Rockefeller's turnaround was extremely important. So those are three or four things we can do to make this a real movement. But, you know, I went to Brandeis University, and the great late Justice Louis Brandeis said, most of the worthwhile things that have been done in this world seemed impossible at the time.
Well, that's a very good way to end our program on a rather optimistic note. The book is Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America. The author, Alan Lichtman. Alan, congratulations on your book. And thank you again for your insights on the aftermath of the death of George Floyd and the protests we're seeing across America. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great question.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. Joining me on the program was VOA senior political analyst Brian Padden. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.